Hello and welcome to One Quarter English. I'm Jenna.
And I'm Mark. Thanks for tuning in. Before we kick things off, Jenna's going to give you a preview of this episode.
That's right. Over the next quarter of an hour, we'll present the latest news headlines from around the world before looking at one of the topics in depth. We'll then discuss one grammar difference between American and British English. After that, you'll find out how to pluralize nouns ending with the letter Y. You'll hear the first installment of a classic story, and then we'll wrap up the podcast with something fun. Enjoy the show.
Meridiane has been rocked by a powerful earthquake, causing widespread devastation, with buildings collapsing, power lines down, and fires raging in several regions. Rescue operations are ongoing with 200 confirmed fatalities and thousands of injured.
In other news, Gulshaston has plunged into chaos after a military coup ousted the civilian government and suspended the constitution. Troops are flooding the streets, enforcing a nationwide curfew as protests erupt. The international community has condemned the takeover, urging for a swift restoration of democracy.
Meanwhile, the manhunt for escaped felon James Thompson ended this morning after police apprehended him from a residence in Marlow. Thompson had eluded police for 2 weeks after escaping from the maximum security prison via its maze-like sewer system.
EU regulators are intensifying their scrutiny of Silicon Valley tech giants, investigating potential anti-competitive practices and unfair market dominance. Concerns center on issues such as data privacy, consumer choice, and algorithmic influence.
Finally, scientists are raising urgent alarms as Arctic ice melt accelerates. Research shows a shocking 95% decrease in the oldest, thickest ice over the past three decades.
I'd like to discuss some of the challenges faced by polar regions, if that's all right with you, Mark.
Definitely. What are your thoughts?
It's terrifying how quickly it's happening. I mean, according to recent studies, Arctic sea ice is melting at a rate of approximately 13.1% per decade, surpassing previous estimates. And the implications are far-reaching. I read a report that said if current trends continue, we could see an ice-free Arctic during the summer months within the next few decades.
That's staggering. But it's not just about the loss of ice, Jenna. The Arctic ecosystem is incredibly fragile, and this rapid change is disrupting the lives of countless species, from polar bears to Arctic seals. Some experts predict that 2/3 of the world's polar bears could be extinct by 2050.
Yes, I've heard that statistic too. And let's not forget the crucial role the Arctic plays in regulating the Earth's climate, and its rapid warming could have cascading effects worldwide. I read a quote somewhere, I'm not sure who said it, but it was definitely an environmentalist. Anyway, this person said, the Arctic is a critical barometer of the health of our planet. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic.
Nicely put. We're already seeing the effects of Arctic warming in extreme weather events, rising sea levels, and disruptions to agriculture and fisheries.
Absolutely. We need to heed these warnings and work together to protect the Arctic and our planet for future generations. The time to act is now.
Of course you're right, Jenna. But what can people do on an individual level?
Well, reducing our carbon footprint is key. We can start by making small changes in our daily lives, like using energy-efficient appliances, reducing our reliance on single-use plastics, and opting for renewable energy sources whenever possible.
Definitely. And we can also support policies and initiatives aimed at combating climate change. Whether it's advocating for renewable energy investments, supporting sustainable agriculture practices, or pushing for stronger environmental regulations, our voices matter.
Absolutely, Mark. We can also make conscious choices in our consumption habits, like reducing meat consumption, even though that might be difficult for some people, because meat does have a significant environmental footprint. Another way is to support companies that prioritize sustainability and ethical practices.
Good point. And let's not forget the power of education and awareness. We can educate ourselves and others about the importance of protecting the Arctic and the broader impacts of climate change, because knowledge is a powerful tool for driving change.
That's true. By spreading awareness and inspiring others to take action, we can amplify our impact and create a ripple effect of positive change. Every individual action counts, and together we can make a difference.
Well said, Jenna. Okay. I'd like to bring up a difference between American and British English that I've never quite understood. Tell me, Jenna, what are your plans for the coming weekend?
Next weekend? I'm not sure. Wait, I think there's a film festival in town starting at the weekend. I'll probably go there.
So you're going to a film festival on the weekend, right? On the weekend?
Oh, I know what you're getting at, Mark. But no, I'm going to a film festival. At, not, on, the weekend.
And therein lies the conundrum. Is it on or at the weekend? I mean, when we teach students prepositions of time, we say that in is the least, and at is the most specific. So years and months go within, but dates and days of the week take on. Specific times like midnight or 5:45 go with that. The weekend is clearly not as specific as an exact time. The weekend is made up of Saturday and Sunday, and they go with on. So why do British speakers say at when they clearly should say on, the weekend?
Yes, I know it doesn't really match with what we try to teach English learners, but it's just one of those differences that exist between British and American English, just like British speakers who say, I have got, and American speakers who say, I have gotten. Both are completely correct.
Yes, on the weekend and at the weekend are both correct, but not everyone knows that. I know someone who used to teach French-Canadian civilians working for the Defense Department. They were required to have a certain level of English depending on their positions, and the practice material provided for the writing test included a gap-fill question in which learners had to choose from in, on, or at the weekend. Only one was correct. And in this case, Canadian English agrees with American English, so if students chose at the weekend, their answer was wrong.
That's crazy.
I know, right? Whoever made that test had no idea that at the weekend is British English. This was 20 years ago, though, so hopefully the test has been changed.
On the weekend or at the weekend, it's your choice. Just make sure you're consistent. I've marked a lot of English papers, Mark, and a lot of English learners have a hard time when it comes to pluralizing nouns that end in a Y. So the words country, or penalty, or attorney. When you say the plural, it's easy. Countries, penalties, attorneys. But spelling them can be tricky. When do you replace the Y with I-E-S? And when do you keep the Y and add an S? There, of course, is a rule. Do you know what it is, Mark?
I sure do, Jenna. It's actually really simple. All you need to do is look at the letter that comes before the Y. If it's a vowel like an attorney, you just add the S for the plural. But if the letter directly before the Y is a consonant, like in country or penalty, you remove the Y and add I-E-S.
Is it really that simple?
Totally that simple. Say any noun that ends with a Y and can be pluralized.
Okay, what about the noun toy?
There's an O before the Y, so you just add an S, T-O-Y-S.
All right, what about autobiography?
Easy. There's an H before the Y, which is a consonant, so you remove the Y and add I-E-S. A-U-T-O-B-I-O-G-R-A-P-H-I-E-S.
You're right, Mark. It's really easy. And I have to add, you're an incredibly fast speller, Mark. Wait a minute. This rule also applies to verbs, right? Buys is spelled Y-S, but amplify is spelled I-E-S. With verbs, you also look at the letter before the Y, right?
Exactly.
If the letter before is a vowel, you just add an S. And if the letter before is a consonant, you remove the Y and add I-E-S. Super. Thanks, Mark.
Anytime, Jenna.
Is it just me, or have there been a lot of Sherlock Holmes-related movies, TV shows, books, and radio plays recently?
No, it's not just you. 2023 was a big year for Sherlock Holmes fans.
Why?
Because every Sherlock Holmes story written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle entered the public domain on January 1st, 2023.
And what does public domain mean exactly?
Well, when a work is in the public domain, it means that it's available for anyone to use, reproduce, modify, and distribute without seeking permission from the original creator or paying royalties.
And why is Sherlock Holmes in the public domain now?
In the EU, copyright protection lasts for 70 years after an author's death. But in both the US and the UK, it's 95 years after the publication of the work. And the final set of Sherlock Holmes stories were published in 1927, which means they were copyright protected until the end of 2022. And this is fantastic news for Sherlock Holmes fans.
You seem to be pretty excited about this, Mark.
I am. And you should be too.
I should?
Yes, you definitely should be excited because we're going to feature some classic Sherlock Holmes stories on this podcast.
We are?
Yes.
And wait a second, Mark. You're not hoping to be the voice of Sherlock Holmes, are you?
Well, actually...
Stop right there. Let me hear your best British accent.
Okay. The evidence clearly points to the butler. It's elementary, my dear Watson.
Was that supposed to be British?
I guess I didn't get the part.
Sorry, Mark, but we'll find a cameo for you.
Thanks, Jenna. I'd appreciate that. And without further ado, here's the first installment of The Speckled Band.
Oh, good. I like that one.
In glancing over my notes of the 70-odd cases in which I have during the last 8 years studied the methods of my friend Sherlock Holmes, I find many tragic. Some comic, a large number merely strange, but none commonplace. For, working as he did rather for the love of his art than for the acquirement of wealth, he refused to associate himself with any investigation which did not tend towards the unusual and even the fantastic. Of all these varied cases, however, I cannot recall any which presented more singular features than that which was associated with the well-known Surrey family of the Roylotts of Stoke Moran. The events in question occurred in the early days of my association with Holmes, when we were sharing rooms as bachelors in Baker Street. It is possible that I might have placed them upon record before, but a promise of secrecy was made at the time, from which I have only been freed during the last month by the untimely death of the lady to whom the pledge was given. It is perhaps as well that the facts should now come to light, for I have reasons to know that there are widespread rumours as to the death of Dr. Grimesby Roylott, which tend to make the matter even more terrible than the truth. It was early in April in the year 83 that I woke one morning to find Sherlock Holmes standing fully dressed by the side of my bed. He was a late riser as a rule, and as the clock on the mantelpiece showed me that it was only 7:15, I blinked up at him in some surprise, and perhaps just a little resentment, for I was myself regular in my habits.
Very sorry to knock you up, Watson, but it's the common lot this morning. Mrs. Hudson has been knocked up, she retorted upon me, and I on you.
What is it then? A fire?
No, a client. It seems that a young lady has arrived in a considerable state of excitement, who insists upon seeing me. She is waiting now in the sitting room. Now, when young ladies wander about the metropolis at this hour of the morning and knock sleepy people up out of their beds, I presume that it is something very pressing which they have to communicate. Should it prove to be an interesting case, you would, I am sure, wish to follow it from the outset. I thought at any rate that I should call you and give you the chance.
My dear fellow, I would not miss it for anything. I had no keener pleasure than in following Holmes in his professional investigations and in admiring the rapid deductions, as swift as intuitions, and yet always founded on a logical basis, with which he unravelled the problems which were submitted to him. I rapidly threw on my clothes and was ready in a few minutes to accompany my friend down to the sitting room. A lady dressed in black and heavily veiled, who had been sitting in the window, rose as we entered.
Good morning, madam. My name is Sherlock Holmes. This is my intimate friend and associate, Dr. Watson, before whom you can speak as freely as before myself. I am glad to see that Mrs. Hudson has had the good sense to light the fire. Pray draw up to it, and I shall order you a cup of hot coffee, for I observe that you are shivering.
It is not cold which makes me shiver.
What then?
It is fear, Mr. Holmes. It is terror.
She raised her veil as she spoke, and we could see that she was indeed in a pitiable state of agitation, her face all drawn and grey with restless, frightened eyes, like those of some hunted animal. Her features and figure were those of a woman of 30, but her hair was shot with premature grey, and her expression was weary and haggard. Sherlock Holmes ran her over with one of his quick, all-comprehensive glances.
You must not fear. We shall soon set matters right. I have no doubt. You have come in by train this morning, I see.
You know me, then?
No, but I observed the second half of a return ticket in the palm of your left glove. You must have started early, and yet you had a good drive in a dog-cart, along heavy roads, before you reached the station.
The lady gave a violent start, and stared in bewilderment at my companion.
There is no mystery, my dear madam. The left arm of your jacket is spattered with mud, in no less than 7 places. The marks are perfectly fresh. There is no vehicle save a dog-cart which throws up mud in that way. and then only when you sit on the left-hand side of the driver.
Whatever your reasons may be, you are perfectly correct. I started from home before 6, reached Leatherhead at 20 past, and came in by the first train to Waterloo. Sir, I can stand this strain no longer. I shall go mad if it continues. I have no one to turn to. None, save only one, who cares for me. And he, poor fellow, can be of little aid. I have heard of you, Mr. Holmes. I have heard of you from Mrs. Farintosh, whom you helped in the hour of her sore need. It was from her that I had your address. Oh, sir, do you not think that you could help me too, and at least throw a little light through the dense darkness which surrounds me? At present, it is out of my power to reward you for your services, but in a month or 6 weeks I shall be married, with the control of my own income, and then at least you shall not find me ungrateful.
Holmes turned to his desk and, unlocking it, drew out a small casebook which he consulted.
Farintosh. Ah, yes, I recall the case. It was concerned with an opal tiara. I think it was before your time, Watson. I can only say, madam, that I shall be happy to devote the same care to your case as I did to that of your friend. As to reward, my profession is its own reward, but you are at liberty to defray whatever expenses I may be put to, at the time which suits you best. And now I beg that you will lay before us everything that may help us in forming an opinion upon the matter.
And that's it for this instalment of The Speckled Band. Next time, we'll find out more about the dense darkness surrounding the mysterious woman asking Sherlock Holmes for help.
Wait, what about my promised cameo?
Sorry, Mark, you'll have to wait a bit for that.
And now for something lighthearted. Are you a fan of tongue twisters, Jenna?
Sure, I've even got a few favorites.
Okay, let me hear one.
Okay, here's a good one. She sells seashells by the seashore. The seashells that she sells are seashells, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know that one. It's a good one. She sells seashells by the seashore. The seashells that she sells are seashells, I'm sure.
Nice, Mark. Now let's see how some other people do.
She sells seashells by the seashore? No. Seashore. The she sells. No, that's not right. The seashells that she sells are seashells, I'm sure.
She sells seashells by the seashore. The seashells that she sells are seashells, I'm sure.
She sells seashells by the seashore. The seashells that she sells are seashells, I'm sure.
She sells seashells by the seashore. The she sells, no. Seashells that she sells are she sells. No, the she sells. No, the seashells that she sells. I give up.
Well, that's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it.
Tune in next time for more headlines, more in-depth discussions, another difference between British and American English, a grammar point explained, and more Sherlock Holmes. Plus, there'll be something fun at the end. Bye for now.
Goodbye.